and welcome to the Mobility Podcast. This is Craig Rogers with Securing America's Future Energy, and I'm here with my lovely co-host,
Pete Gould of Shared Mobility Strategy.
You always kind of snicker or smirk when I
you call me lovely. Compliment.
Maybe inaccurate. And on behalf of Greg Rodriguez, views are our own, and we are at the TRB annual meeting 2020. Is this the 99th year?
It's 100.
100. This is 100.
I took the photo and everything.
Oh, I did. Yeah. I'm not much a reader. But we're excited to be recording here for the 100th TRB annual meeting.
With an avid reader.
I'm an avid reader.
Not you. this is going to be an interesting one. Hang in there.
It's going to take a wild edit. Joining us today is Nathaniel Hordam and Jason Hanlon from the Center for Transportation and the Environment. So welcome, guys.
Thank you, Greg. Thank you, Pete. Good to be here.
I think many of you will recognize as Ed Niedermeyer said, the incorrigible scooter curmudgeon, Nathaniel.
We're not talking about scooters today, I don't think, though.
We're not talking about scooters today. But first, let's start off by talking about
scooters.
About scooters. Or Atlanta politics. Would you like to do that one?
No, I pass on that one, too, today.
Right. So let's go to the boring stuff, then. Let's talk about transportation policy. But what do you guys do?
Jason, you want to take that?
Sure. So we kind of fit in kind of a niche space, I guess, a little bit. We're a nonprofit, 501c3. We were started in the early 90s out of a DARPA grant to develop hybrid electric Humvees. And so basically when they put that program together, they realized that they wanted to establish consortia, nonprofit consortia, to be able to oversee and manage the funding and flow of funding, but also oversee the technical aspects of the development and allow all of the equipment integrators and developers and component developers and suppliers to focus on, you know, doing the work of developing the vehicle. So that's kind of where we started, and we took that model and have grown it to really focusing overall on the development, deployment, and commercialization of clean transportation technologies.
Cool.
So anything clean. It's going great. I mean, we're definitely starting to see, you know, a lot of stuff get out into the market. Transit buses are leading the way. Well, we focus on medium and heavy duty. We don't do as much in the passenger vehicle space. Mm-hmm. So any kind of trucks, you know, transit buses, school buses, delivery vans,
port equipment.
We're doing a lot of port equipment in California right now, top loaders, and things like that. So. So yeah, I mean it's going good, and I think we see now is a lot of the stuff that kind of came out of the transit space is starting to move towards you know the other medium and heavy duties vehicles.
That's fascinating because you would logically think that the private industry from the trucking that they would do the major advancements in this and that would then trickle down to transit. It's coming the other way. What's driving that? Is that from federal investment and research or use cases?
It is. FTA investment was pretty critical, and I can talk about that in a second. But it's also because transit buses are an awesome platform for developing any kind of new technology. One of the biggest reasons is they're centrally fueled. So you can do fueling or charging infrastructure at the agency itself. They're centrally managed. You have professional drivers that really know what's happening. Transit buses are already subsidized. Purchase of transit buses is pretty subsidized already. So
Repetitive routes.
Yeah, you can add on to that. The public gets to experience the new technology early on. They're not as susceptible to weight and volume increases. Mm-hmm. So that's really one of the biggest reasons. And you know, we kind of saw that. I mean, the perfect example is Proterra.
And they had Ryan on, I think.
Yeah, we did.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. You know, that's kind of the model and that's kind of, it kind of also speaks to what we do at CTE. We back, I guess, probably 10, 15 years ago, FTA had started a program called the National Fuel Cell Bus Program. Mm-hmm. So they were putting out awards through this consortium model. So they were awarding projects through organizations like CTE. We were one of the three. Mm-hmm. And as we were putting projects together, we were approached by Dale Hill and a couple other guys, and they said, hey, look, we've got an idea for, you know, a purpose-built electric bus, a lightweight electric bus. And it was literally, he's sketching it out on a napkin. And so we got, we got that funded, and we led that project. The development of that was in Colorado, Golden, Colorado, and we had, you know, we did develop the propulsion system on a school bus that, that Dale bought. And so, you know, you can see, you know, kind of where that went.
Right.
And so it kind of speaks to being able to, you know, put this technology together on a transit bus with federal, with FTA funds.
And I know, you know, you guys had Ryan on a few months ago, and I think he talked a little bit about, I think Ryan talked a little bit about their commercialization strategy into other vehicle platforms. I was just walking outside earlier today and saw a Thomas built school bus, diesel school bus driving down street outside, and, you know, Proterra's partnering with them now, licensing their powertrain, their battery technology, in their, I think it's a Jouley is what they're calling it, that joint venture. They're trying to license that to the heavy duty trucking space as folks increasingly look toward electrification of those platforms as well. So, you know, all of that did emerge. I mean, originally Proterra was fuel cell electric. Now they've gone battery electric, but they really catalyzed the entire industry.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about sort of electric school buses? And because we're seeing that is coming into a lot of discussions is, okay, if people's kids are riding an electric school bus, they're going to be a lot more comfortable too. Jason, you had hinted at sort of consumer acceptance being helped by transit buses too, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's a perfect application for EVs, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, for electric buses, just because, well, not only because, you know, children's lungs are more susceptible to localized, you know, pollution, but also because of the duty cycle of the buses. I mean, if they're range, if they're range limited, or you don't have to put as big of a battery, if they're going out in the morning, coming back when they can charge, going back out in the afternoon. So, you know, and a lot of communities and school districts want school buses, obviously. I mean, it's just a good story. The real challenge is the cost side of the equation.
Right.
You know, if you're for the propulsion system equipment, if you're adding a couple hundred thousand onto, you know, a $550,000 transit bus, then that's easier to justify. And there's also programs to help support that. But if you're adding a couple hundred thousand onto a $100,000 school bus, you know, they're pretty cheap, $150,000, then, you know, it's three times the cost of a bus. Mm-hmm. So that's really the challenge there is, you know, and they run those buses hard. So, you know, that's kind of what we have to overcome somehow.
And we're starting to see federal activity too, finally mm-hmm. kind of picking up this issue, recognizing that it's something that, you know, transit hasn't always had a lot of bipartisan support. It's been primarily a Democratic-led, at least in more recent years, a more Democratic-led initiative. But with school buses, you know, it's the air our kids breathe, right? Or not my kids personally, because I don't have any kids. But, you know, America's children.
You can use my kids.
Yeah, your kids. But no, it's the air our America's children breathe, and it's easier to get consensus around that. You know, something else that I think ultimately is going to end up driving this conversation a lot, no pun intended, is rural agencies, especially in depopulating areas. They're, you know, they're challenged budget-wise. They may get state support, and if you can help with, you know, the capital cost in some way, whether it's through a federal grant program, certain states are now putting together grant programs to support this, ultimately you're helping them on the operations side. Mm-hmm. And the utilities like it too, because they're getting these big batteries that have a predictable duty cycle, mm-hmm. and they can start to look into this, you know, vehicle to grid integration concept,
right.
which you also see with transit buses, but right. There's a lot more opportunity there that, you know, it's only finally starting to get noticed, though.
Can you talk about vehicle to grid for everyone who's unfamiliar?
Well, quite simply, it's just, you know, taking energy that you've already put on the vehicle somehow and getting it back onto the grid.
Right.
To level loads or demand. A lot of the chargers out there are kind of enabled, but it's just we're not seeing it done. It needs to be managed and controlled mm-hmm. correctly, you know. And there are utility programs that can do that, but they're slowly coming on board. But that's definitely something we see the need for, and we are continuing to push for projects and programs that will demonstrate that kind of optimization, smart charging mm-hmm. or charge management. And so managing the flow of energy going back and forth and stored energy at infrastructure, there's a lot to be done there, and it can certainly optimize how much power you need and mm-hmm. The cost of distributing power. So we want to continue to see programs that'll demonstrate that at a much larger scale, because large scale charging infrastructure is really one of the biggest challenges right now, especially in transit.
And you know, I'll just add on that, you see the vehicle to grid concept. It's not quite in 5G or smart city territory where it's just overused, but a lot of people, I think, misuse it when they talk about light vehicles and the need to push light EVs or passenger EVs on the market. At the end of the day, Tesla battery, 120 kilowatt hours or something like that, it doesn't do a whole lot. People charge at home occasionally, they charge at work occasionally, they charge at grocery stores, and it's an unpredictable, you know, charge cycle, and so the utilities mm-hmm. can't really do a whole lot with that. But once you start talking about, you know, and I'm starting to promote this in Atlanta a little bit more, because also Bluebird manufactures in Fort Valley, Central Georgia, near Macon Warner Robins. You know, the Atlanta region has something like 6,000 school buses. And so if you electrify all of that with 440 kilowatt hour batteries or more, or, you know, something around that, plus MARTA's transit bus fleet at 500, you know, transit buses, they're going to expand maybe 1,000 once Cobb and Gwinnett counties buy in. So you start to see just all of this battery capacity coming online with regular duty cycles. And then the other thing,
or known duty cycles.
And then the other thing too is, as we increasingly trend toward, and Georgia's a bit different because we're the only state still building nuclear, but you know, that's a high base load. You don't turn nuclear power generation off, mm-hmm. and so it's constantly producing in an off-peak hours. You know, you got to put that energy somewhere. As we increasingly go towards solar power across the country, also there's a period of time when that's all producing during the day. And So being able to plug in these, you know, massive batteries to the system on a fleet level in a predictable way, you can start to do a lot of really interesting things.
Now, you know, the big push for why transit buses, you know, make sense for electric is that they're high mileage, high usage, and therefore that make, you know, the economics work the more, you know, the more you're driving. Mm-hmm. Does that still apply on school buses? If, you know, how can they be utilized during the day, you know, in between the kind of pickup and drop off?
Well, I guess I think probably as energy suppliers, mm-hmm. you know, back to as an energy storage device. But you're right. It really where the optimization needs to occur is on the charging side. When you put chargers out there, you really want to try to utilize chargers. But it gets back to having to utilize, you know, the school buses. But I don't know how to improve the economics by increasing utilization of the school buses.
Maybe microtransit.
I don't know the answer to that one.
Who from the feds is doing the investment in here? Is this DOE or DOT or
with school buses
Department
or
of Education?
There's really school buses. They're typically funded by the school districts themselves,
or the states.
Some states will actually fund.
So the proposals we're seeing floating around right now, Senator Kamala Harris has, I know, put a bill out there last year that's trying to create similar to the low and no emission bus program through FTA, that we, you know, do a lot of those projects. You know, setting up a similar type of program with a competitive grants program annually, that sort of thing, I think would be run out of DOT. I've seen other things where they want to run it out of DOE. That's all still, you know, to be decided, but it really could be either one.
You know, maybe one of the biggest programs, which is a California program called HVIP. It's a voucher program for commercialized medium and heavy duty on road trucks, and they just came out with one for off road trucks. So it's basically a voucher to pay for that incremental cost of transit buses, work at utility trucks, just about anything. And so that's a big boost for school bus, being able to pay for those school buses. And that's funded through their cap and trade program, which has been pretty successful.
Yeah, HVIP seems to be oversubscribed, right?
It is oversubscribed.
Yeah. Do you know how they, because I think the idea was that they're going to fully cover the incremental cost, right?
Mm-hmm.
But the interesting thing is that the cost of these vehicles is really hard to find online.
Right.
How do they do that?
Well, that's a good question. CARB does a really good job of reaching out to the manufacturers. They also reach out to groups like us. It's kind of strange. We know a lot of costs because we put in a lot of proposals.
Yeah.
So we know how they get costed. So they'll reach out to us and ask us what we're seeing as we're, putting in proposals. So they do a good job of trying to figure it out. And, as I look through them, I'm also surprised that they generally tend to get it right or get it pretty close. I mean, they have higher incremental costs for fuel cell buses versus electric, so they account for that. But they actually do a pretty good job.
Very cool. Can we turn to transit automation?
Sure. Let's do it.
I see that wry grin. So, Nathaniel, you have a lot of opinions on how transit automation should move forward. And everything. But I think you're one of the people who I think understands some of the technical challenges that a lot of other folks aren't talking about with transit automation. You can't just slap LiDAR on top of a bus and then call it an AEV, right?
No, and it's interesting. So Jason kind of set the table earlier talking about how transit led on these powertrain systems for medium and heavy duty. When it comes to the automation space, we are the laggard. I mean, it's crazy when you see the billions of dollars that have gone into light passenger vehicle, the robo-taxi concept, and now increasingly into the heavy duty trucking space for automation of those platforms. And you've seen tens of millions of dollars poured into these low-speed shuttle, the automated shuttles, the May Mobilities. They just, Navya Easy Mile. I know May just closed a $20 million round with Toyota. So, and they've actually also been able to somewhat subsidize their development costs through every city that wants to do a downtown AV circulator is some sort of economic development driver.
Mm-hmm.
With transit buses, I would guess, if I had to put a guess on the global investment, private investment from the manufacturers themselves into the technology is probably less combined than what May Mobility had just gotten from Toyota. It's probably less than $20 million right now. So the development hasn't been there. Typically, this innovation is driven by federal investment. The Integrated Mobility Innovation Grant challenge is out right now. I'm sure by the time you publish this, it'll probably have been awarded. Which is starting to fund demonstrations on the FTA's Strategic Transit Automation Research Plan. There are a total of five demonstrations that they want funded through that. That's kind of the first piece, the ADS grants that I know you've talked about before. We put in a proposal with New Flyer and Robotic Research and MARTA. To do automated transit buses. Proterra put in multiple proposals. A couple of other agencies put in similar proposals. I think total there were six or seven transit bus projects. None of them got awarded. So the investment hasn't been there to date.
Mm-hmm. And does it take federal investment? Does it have to be federal? How do we get that shift to happen?
We're talking to folks in the private sector trying to figure out if there's a way to kind of stimulate something. But generally speaking, transit bus manufacturers, it's a profitable business. It's not a hugely profitable business. Mm-hmm.
It's a very conservative business, and they really don't like to invest in product development unless the customers are demanding it. Right. And so what we're finding now with transit bus automation is these transit agencies are starting to feel out, and I know they're talking to some consultants here and there and trying to understand, you know, what they can actually do feasibly in the short or medium term. And what we're seeing is they're kind of moving toward a couple of use cases as their primary interest. One is ADAS for safety purposes. I actually also, and I've been promoting fairly recently, the fact that ADAS could probably also be a major driver of energy efficiency and actually help zero emission bus, battery electric bus adoption.
Mm-hmm. And just general operational benefits of
smoother driving.
Saving lives, maybe.
Also important. I mean, safety's, obviously, it's not quite as big an issue with transit buses because they are professional drivers. Right. Compared to the number of road miles traveled, it's tiny.
You know, I was going to say, what is, let's step back. Why automated transit?
Exactly. Yep. Mm-hmm. And so I think, you know, part of the pressure on transit agencies right now, it's not about replacing drivers. It's about being able to fill role, I mean, having automation plug a gap where they can't hire drivers. So I think originally some of these agencies thought in that respect they might be able to use automation in a tight labor market, to essentially plug the gap where they can't hire enough. They can't retain drivers because ultimately drivers do a lot beyond just drive a bus. They provide onboard security. They do ADA compliance. They drive long, long cycles without bathroom breaks or lunch breaks. It's a tough job. Mm-hmm. And so if you think about all the things a bus driver does, it goes beyond the driving task. And then you start to realize, well, we may never actually get transit buses without someone working for the transit agency on it.
And so at which point don't you then just have a more expensive bus with all this?
Unless you have additional benefits from safety, reducing liability. I mean, when buses get in accidents, it's a $10 million plus affair.
Between the bus itself, the lawsuits.
Yeah. Because when a bus hits somebody,
it's a cash cow.
Yeah. Well, it's also pretty serious. I mean, it's a heavy vehicle, right? So there's that piece of it. There's an energy efficiency piece of it. And then they're also interested in yard automation. Mm-hmm. What we've noticed as we're now increasingly helping a lot of larger agencies plan their transition to fully electric fleets, and they've got to plan for charging infrastructure. They've got to retain more buses as spares, at least while we're working through the range issues in the industry. The batteries still aren't capable of replacing most routes that agencies operate. So before, when you had a diesel that could run all day, you can't just stick a battery electric bus out there and replace it. So you may have to actually get two buses to be able to replace that single diesel or CNG. So that's more yard space. If you're a rural agency, not a big deal. If you're LA Metro or CTA or New York, yard space is a premium. And so being able to automate, do self-parking, the self-valet, I think is what it's typically called in the light vehicle space. Mm-hmm. To do that, to be able to automate charging cycles, procure fewer chargers. I mean, these are not, $10,000 plugins in your home. These are, once installation's factored in, you're talking about anywhere from $75,000 to $120,000 for a plug-in charger at a depot.
Right, and so not having to do that one-to-one, charger per bus is pretty critical, especially when it's pretty complex when you try to design, a depot or a charging facility. I mean, you have so many options available to you, from overhead conductive, fast charge or slower charge or wireless inductive charging, that you can move buses around and share these resources, mm-hmm. and be able to charge a little bit faster and move them through, charging areas or charging bays, instead of having to have, as soon as they come in, a bus plugged in. Mm-hmm. So there's some optimization that can be done there by doing this. The yard operations autonomy just enables that.
And so it may actually not end up eliminating anyone's job. I mean, this is something where,
you may be able to actually get enough efficiencies once the system's developed, right? And going back to my original point, there's not been any investment to date. Transit buses are really hard to automate compared with other vehicle platforms, only because the guts of the vehicle, I mean, the driveline, the steering, the braking systems are really, they're pneumatic brakes, they're hydraulic steering systems. That's not easy to do drive-by-wire, which is a precondition for all of this. Mm. Light vehicles now, everyone's using electronic power steering systems. Everyone's doing brake-by-wire too now.
Mm-hmm. Can you quickly explain what drive-by-wire and brake-by-wire means?
Yeah, so basically everything is electronically controlled.
Mm-hmm. Not mechanically. So, yeah. I mean, basically you're communicating, sending a signal to whatever electric solenoids
or actuators.
Which is what allows
a computer to operate it, because it's not about physically turning a wheel as much as sending a signal.
And you wouldn't have a drive shaft or steering column that basically turns the wheels. You're just sending a communication to something that's doing it for you.
And the motor is not powerful enough typically on a heavy-duty vehicle to do braking, so you end up with air brakes, mm-hmm. which are horribly energy inefficient. Mm-hmm. But there are people working on hydraulic systems or electro-hydraulic systems that could ultimately replace that.
Why is that hard? Is it because you have to have someone pressing the pedal to act? What is it that makes it difficult?
You're stopping
it electric.
You're stopping
a large object.
Right. You're stopping a 20,000 pound.
What makes it difficult to make that an electric function, though?
They have to do all sorts of workarounds. Mm-hmm. I don't actually quite understand at that technical level. But
also,
buses
are big. I guess
buses are big. But I mean,
heavy things stop slow.
And talking with the OEMs and understanding their processes, they're trying to go through and develop prototype vehicles for automation. Mm-hmm. This is a hugely expensive process. Mm-hmm. And so even if you can do a demonstration, which is valuable, we're trying to do it. And we hope we see some come online in the next couple of years. Mm-hmm. To actually manufacture this stuff at scale, at any sort of volume, it's just not practical right now.
Yeah.
So we need to see a lot more investment in those driveline systems. We're seeing actually now, I think ZF and Nexteer, among others, have developed electronic power steering systems for heavy-duty trucks. Great. Let's see that commercialized, mm-hmm. bring that over into the transit bus space, and that's going to make the steering actuation a lot easier. Mm-hmm. So, and I've also talked a lot about trying to instead maybe not just do automation, but do teleoperations, because you can still get the yard, basically anything you can do in yard automation, you can do with, teleoperations instead, without having to invest in development of, automated driving systems. There's no AI involved. It's just camera-based system, and someone links in. Have you had anyone on to talk about it, or
we haven't actually? But what's what's the difference? What's the advantage of having someone teleoperating a bus when you can just have them in person doing that?
Theoretically, because you can. We talked about this at Transportation Camp. The big issue I think always is going to keep coming back to labor. When you're talking about transit, because there is a huge advantage here of if you've got four buses that you need to move in and out and do it quickly, whether you're realistically not going to be having probably four different drivers, one in each bus, but having one guy jump from each. But if you're able to do it through teleops, you're able to move this one, and then that same operator can be switched over to move this one, and you don't have to actually jump from one to the other.
You're eliminating physical distance. And also, if you're a larger agency that has multiple bus depots, now you can kind of centralize that operation in your central maintenance facility or in another command center of sorts. There may be labor savings from that at the yard. That's still going to create some labor issues.
When you hear labor savings means...
Right.
13C means... We should,
and it's not necessarily eliminated jobs. I mean, drivers do a lot of inspections. They actually do, especially at smaller agencies, mm-hmm. they run these things through the charge cycle. They do inspections in the morning. They do inspections at night. They maybe don't do the janitorial stuff, but, there's time associated with that they may not have to do anymore. We're still trying to figure this out. FTA is researching the labor impacts of all of this. And they'll probably end up putting you know, values, you know, dollar values on certain processes, but it's just something we need to see more research on. But regardless, for teleoperation, you still need drive-by-wire. So until you fix that fundamental engineering problem, you know, you're just not going to be able to get there at scale. So, you know, we're trying to communicate that out there and start getting transit agencies thinking about this a little bit differently. Stop thinking about removing the driver. Think about ADAS for safety, which also requires drive-by-wire. And then, you know, potential yard operations efficiencies, whether it's through automation or teleoperations.
And driving efficiency improvements. I mean, you know, we see, we do a lot of data collection analysis on fleets that are already out there, and we look at the drivers, quote-unquote drivers, for that drive fuel economy. And with EVs, it's really important, and because your environment will really change the efficiency of the buses, whether it's, you know, HVAC loads, or it's duty cycle, it's grades, but driver habits and aggressive driving is one of the biggest factors, honestly.
We've seen on certain deployments range efficient or efficiency loss of up to 25% just based on a driver. That's not the average. But when you're planning this stuff out as an agency and you've got to plan for the worst case scenario on a route, losing potentially an additional 25% on an already constrained battery range is a big deal. And if you can start to normalize that by getting rid of essentially the lead foot problem, that's a big deal.
Well, it's the way we started this, I thought that was so funny because, you know, the transit agency has some of the most skilled drivers on the roads, but you're still seeing some of those problems with lead foots and things like that.
Well, this is another issue with, you know, with labor retention right now. So, I mean, we have a tight labor market, and, you know, I was on the Autonicast talking about the impacts on Uber, you know, and the fact that they have a hard time retaining gig workers at this point. Well, bus drivers, it's a similar thing. They're having to raise wages across the board. It drives up operations costs, but ultimately it's you have, you know, less well-trained drivers in your fleet, and the more churn that you have, you're going to have, you know, potentially greater, you know, greater variability in drive quality.
Gotcha. Well, it's also it's very difficult driving. You know, it's in addition to just regular craziness of driving in an urban environment, you add in the driving over to, you know, pulling over from one side to get to a stop there and then having to cross over.
Well, the biggest factor is you're trying to maintain a schedule.
And you got a schedule.
So that's why a lot of agencies will say, we can't do anything about, you know, the lead foot, basically the inefficient driving, is because our drivers need to maintain schedule. We can't worry about that. Now, you do have a lot of other agencies that do try to address it, and there's ways to do it. You can put bulletin board metrics up if you're allowed to, you know, if you're non-labor. You can put metrics up on who's leading in terms of efficiency, do things like that, and or recurrent training. But anyway,
and let me just talk about Connecticut real quick. So we put another, you know, one of the IMI opportunities that I talked about, we did put in an ADAS proposal with the Connecticut Department of Transportation, and they operate the CT Fast Track. It's a completely separated, you know, dedicated right-of-way for a BRT route that goes into downtown Hartford. The downtown Hartford piece would not be automated, but anything on that separated guideway with platform boarding, we would be using ADAS, particularly for platform docking. And so the FTA was researching this 10 years ago using magnets to try and align the buses, you know, for precision docking, because if a bus doesn't line up, you know, properly and the platform gaps are too large, they either have to like deploy a metal ramp. So you know, anyone who has a mobility impairment, wheelchair riders, you know, so they can actually board safely, or they may even try to remaneuver, back up and try again. So that's a big issue. And then, like, for instance, I was in Indianapolis in September and I rode the new Indigo, you know, BRT line there. And they use articulated 60-foot buses. And I sat in the back portion of it and I watched. We had platform gaps of a foot or 2 feet at some points because, you know, you're a driver that has to perform that maneuver however many times an hour. You're stopping every half mile, third of a mile, and trying to align perfectly with this platform.
Right.
That's really challenging to do on a repetitive basis. And this is one place that automation or, you know, ADAS would really help.
Right, you can bring it within inches of the platform.
And as more agencies across the country are turning to platform boarding, BRT, mm-hmm. there's an operational advantage there. Obviously, you don't have to kneel the bus. There's time savings. You know, this is something that more and more will look at. The only thing I'll say is with Connecticut, that's kind of a unique situation with the separated guideway. Only they, LA Metro, and I think one or two other agencies, the LA Metro Orange Line, there are only a few agencies around the country that have that sort of facility.
But even on the wireless charging side, we do a lot of deployments with underground wireless charging for electric buses and other vehicles, top loaders and that sort of thing. And the better alignment you get, the more efficient that inductive charging is. Huh. So it drops off fairly quick. It depends on how it's all tuned, but it drops off fairly quick as you get, you know, misaligned by 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 inches. Mm-hmm. So that also plays a role in efficiency, especially with EVs and electric buses. Mm-hmm. So
the bottom line is there's a way to promote this in a way that doesn't scare anybody about losing their, at least as a driver, that you're not going to lose your job. There are a lot of things we can do to increase efficiencies, operational efficiencies across the board, and create a better riding experience that, you know, ultimately will make the driving task a lot easier too.
Mm-hmm. Very cool. I think we're around time.
Okay.
But guys, thank you so much for joining us. Jason, Nathaniel, where can people find you online?
I'm on Twitter.
You're on?
Yeah, I'm on Twitter at NW_Horadam, HORADAM. You can also find us at GhostGo_CTE. Is our official Twitter account.
CTE.TV is our website, and definitely encourage anybody, you know, to go out and look. We are a member-based organization. We're mission-driven, so that's why a lot of federal and state agencies like to use us. Our mission really is to commercialize clean technology, so we do it in an unbiased way. We do it to support our members and technology providers. That's our whole goal. So certainly encourage anybody to go to www.cte.tv and get a look at our projects and what we've done. We've moved over, I don't know, 400,000 or 400 million in programs and projects since our inception. That's probably a lot higher than that now. But definitely encourage anybody to reach out to us and get involved. And we want to continue to move this area, you know, further.
Excellent. And Pete, where can we find you online?
You can find me on Twitter at SharedMobilitySS.
And I'm at AV Greg R. Follow the Mobility Podcast at Mobility Podcast. And thanks for joining us, guys.
Thank you for having us.